Hi there, I'm Dave Anthony, and this is the Garage to Stadiums podcast. On each episode, we tell you the story of how one of our music legends rose from obscurity to fame and play some of the songs that marked that journey.
Welcome to Garage to Stadiums. Today's story is about the band Fleetwood Mac. Whether you're a casual fan or a Mac diehard, what you're about to hear is an incredible story. As you'll learn, Fleetwood Mac has had three very different eras over their history, and if you can believe it, over 18 different band members. Once you hear this episode, I think you'll agree that this band has an absolute soap opera of interband romantic relationships, breakups, drug addictions, band breakups. They even had one member leave the band to join a cult. And yet to this day, Fleetwood Mac remains one of the most successful groups of all time. When they first started, Fleetwood Mac was a group heading down a completely different music style path, almost unrecognizable to the subsequent radio hits that we all recognize. Talent, tragedy, incredible strokes of fate, and perseverance have all come together to create one of the most iconic sounds in the history of rock. This band has sold a monumental 120 million plus albums. To tell us the story of Fleetwood Mac, we have today's guest, Mark Blake. Mark is an author who's written about music since 1989. He's authored books on bands like The Who, Queen, Pink Floyd, and Led Zeppelin. His upcoming book, Dreams, the A to Z of Fleetwood Mac, is coming out this coming fall, and Garage to Stadium listeners today have the early privilege of hearing about its insider details. Mark is joining us from London in the UK. Welcome to Garage to Stadiums, Mark.
Hi, nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Fleetwood Mac started way back in 67. But before we get into the specifics of the band, I'd like you, Mark, to set the stage for our listeners of what it was like in England in the early to mid 60s, the type of music that was sort of pervasive at the day.
Well, they were part of what was called the sort of blues boom, R&B, British R&B boom, which is basically, in many cases, working class or middle class white English or British kids that became absolutely fascinated by black American music. America wasn't really interested, but the British were. So they were totally into Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Sonny Boy Williamson. Oh, smokes that lightning, shining just like gold. That's where the Stones, certainly less so the Beatles, but the Stones, there was this fascination with blues. And it was difficult to get hold of those records. They weren't played on the radio. They had to be bought as imports. So that makes anything more attractive. If it's slightly taboo or it's slightly hidden and it requires some thought, that was part of the popularity, I think, of blues. It was difficult music to get hold of and it was seen as authentic. So what you had is these kind of white middle-class English boys, and it was often boys, trying to copy, you know, their black American heroes.
Right. It's very fascinating that obviously the black musicians were unknown to white America. White English men primarily play the music and then export it back to the U.S.
We sold it back to you. Yeah. I mean, it's hilarious. The Rolling Stones, it's very funny.
Unbelievable. Interestingly, the founder of the band, Fleetwood Mac, was a guitar player named Peter Green, who was only in the band for a few years. Peter Green's original name was Peter Greenbaum. He grew up in East London in a Jewish family, and his dad was a butcher. In his teens, Mark, he became somewhat of a guitar prodigy after learning guitar from his older brother. Tell us a little bit more about Peter and his founding mission for Fleetwood Mac.
Well, I mean, Peter was a very gifted guitar player, but quite a sensitive person, quite a fragile person. He could be incredibly, I think, bullish and super confident, had a lot of bravado. But from the moment he sort of decided he wanted to become a guitar player, he encountered Mick Fleetwood and John McVie on the circuit and Jeremy Spencer as well, who was their second guitar player. And he sort of came together from there. His original thing was to put together a Chicago blues. Watch out for me, woman,
and don't mind nobody else. And so it's interesting because it very much started as that blues vein. The fans who know Fleetwood Mac wouldn't really maybe know about that history. What were the origins of the Fleetwood Mac band name?
Mick Fleetwood and John McVie. He liked the idea of naming the band after two other guys other than himself. It was a story he gave at the time, was that if I disappear, if I go, if I leave, you still got the band name to carry on.
How successful was the early Fleetwood Mac sort of blues era, I guess I'll call it?
They put two albums, two studio albums out in 1968, about 8 months apart. They had a great reputation as a live act. They were a really loud, raucous live act, but they knocked out those first two albums, like I say, in a matter of months. And by the end of 68, beginning of 69, they're moving into a different direction. It's Peter Green pushing them away from the blues.
I see. How would you characterize the change then? What happened to the music?
First of all, he brought in another guitar player called Danny Kerwin. So you've got Peter Green, who's being heralded as one of the greatest guitarists in the country, along with Eric Clapton, because he wanted to expand the sound. He didn't just want to be the only guitar. I mean, their big breakthrough hit here was called Albatross, which is that instrumental, which doesn't sound anything like the blues. And it upset a lot of their blues audience that were used to them, you know, doing blues. But it was immediately the beginning of something else, something different.
Let's play that, a little bit of that Albatross now.
Yeah, and then so you've got Albatross, which is this very kind of chilled out. So that's kind of stuff that's not going to scare mums and dads even. Parents like that kind of music. Then the next thing you've got is a song called The Green Manalishi. He's also experimenting with mescaline, which is an hallucinogenic. So you've got this very dense, scary kind of heavy metal song. One minute you're just ripping off black American bluesmen and having a good time and singing about sex and drinking. Next minute, you've got a song called The Green Manalishi with the two-pronged crown. It's like, what does it mean? You know, immediately it's like to go somewhere very, very different.
Can't believe that you need my love so bad. Come sneaking around, trying to drive me mad.
Right. And then I guess we move into the phase, Mark. Something rather tragic happens that sort of changes the course of this band. Talk about what happens to our founder, Peter Green.
Well, it happened over a period of time. And when I interviewed Peter Green, he's talking, one minute he's sitting talking normally like you and I are now. And then the next minute he's imagining that there's somebody sat next to me, a woman wearing a yellow dress. And there wasn't. So he could be completely normal, cracking jokes, laughing about how successful Fleetwood Mac were and how many millions of records they sold. And then it'll turn immediately to something he's seeing or experiencing something else. And this is how his behavior became towards the end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s. But there is some evidence that, you know, there were mental health issues there anyway, but they got exacerbated perhaps by taking acid. There was an experience where they went to a commune in Munich. And he spent a day there, took acid and so on. And the band always claimed he was never the same when he came back. But what it meant was that he left the group. That was what happened. So at the peak of their success, just as they're starting to make money, they lose him. And he is the primary songwriter, the primary force in the band.
Right. So now we're in what, 1970-ish?
Yeah, 70. Yeah.
And so Peter's left. Mick Fleetwood, I guess, takes over as the de facto leader. Christine Perfect was her maiden name, brought in after marrying John McVie.
It ends up with Mick Fleetwood and the McVies, Danny Kerwin for a bit, Bob Welch, the American, comes in, then Danny Kerwin, he disappears. Keep up with this because it's...
Yes, you need a scorecard here. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it is, definitely. So, that's sort of where we're at by about 1971. By 1971, they're all living in a big house in the Hampshire countryside, all of them, the band and their roadies and dogs. Some of them have got young kids. And in the midst of this guy called Bob Welch, who's an American, who arrives in Britain. You know, like, his musical career has been up and down. He's got nothing.
It's like, do you want to join Fleetwood Mac? He's like, well, okay.
Yeah.
So his description of coming from Los Angeles, he's a Hollywood guy, born and bred in Hollywood, coming to the Hampshire countryside with these people that he described as like trying to live with members of the royal family. just their Englishness, their airs and graces, everything. He's a fish out of water.
Right.
A guy who actually did an awful lot to keep that band going.
Huh. Interesting. So how would you characterize era two of Fleetwood Mac then? As I'll call it era two.
You call it, yeah. It's just this, it's like the forgotten Fleetwood Mac. I mean, there's four or five albums, like, and there's good stuff on those records, but they're not cohesive. You've got to cherry pick through it.
Right.
But it's very much the Bob, it's the period in which Bob Welch and Christine McVie start writing songs, often and sharing ideas together. And they become the driving force songwriting within the band. And they tour America. They get quite big in America. Not massive, but quite big. But they're forgotten in the UK. You know, they don't have hits or anything like that.
So the trajectory of the band, they sort of changed to a US focus. Why don't we play a song from one of the album's Future Games? There's a song called Sands of Time, and I'm playing this to show really the early start of some harmonies that might play a future role in this band.
Drop away the sunshine, the magic of a black and
green dawn. Drummer Mick Fleetwood emerges as the band's leader. Tell us a bit about Mick, his personality. Where did he grow up?
Well, Mick's father was a wing commander in the Royal Air Force, and he went to a number of different what's called private schools, fee-paying schools. So you get minor royal family members and politicians there, and he was absolutely useless academically. The only thing he was good at doing was playing drums, fencing. He was very good at fencing and dressing as a woman in school productions because, of course, they're boys' schools. So he was very tall and slim and feminine looking. They stick a dress on him, and you know, he could play Ophelia in Shakespeare. But he was absolutely useless academically. But his parents supported him, and he moved to London when he was 15, lived with his sister, and was playing in bars and clubs when he was 15, 16, or thereabouts. The one thing he wanted to do was music, and the one thing he wanted to keep going was Fleetwood Mac by any means that it took. So it's like the guy would stick, he stuck with them through thick and thin. So it doesn't matter how many people leave.
Yeah.
You will find someone else to replace them.
Yeah. He's the one constant throughout the band, isn't
Absolutely.
He?
Absolutely, yeah.
And a little known tidbit, he married the sister of someone relatively famous.
Yeah, he was married to a fashion model called Jenny Boyd, his sister Patty Boyd with George Harrison for many, many years. In fact, he married Jenny Boyd twice. He divorced her and then married her again, and then they got divorced again. But I mean, those sisters must imagine what life was like for those sisters in the 70s. One of them's married to George Harrison. One of them's married to Mick Fleetwood. It's like hard work.
Yeah.
It's hard work.
That's hard work. In what has to be one of the most incredible against the odds stroke of luck in the history of rock, we've got this era two band that's, as you said, unknown in the UK, transitioned to the US, traveling around the US, trying to get rolling again. They go into, I guess, Mick goes into Scout Studios. Tell us what happens. That's probably the seminal moment that puts these this next era over the top.
Yeah, he's in a recording studio up in the hills, isn't it? Up in LA. And he's gone grocery shopping. Bumps into a guy who works at the studio. And Mick Fleetwood.
This is one of the luckiest grocery trips ever taken.
One of the greatest. And that store is still there. This guy comes up to me in the store and recognizes him, says, I'm working out this studio, Sound City, I think it was called. And says, look, why don't you check it out? And Mick Fleetwood's going, well, I'm looking for somewhere to make the next Fleetwood Mac album. So he goes up there. And while he's there, he's introduced to the producer, a guy called Keith Olsen, who I interviewed a few years ago. He's no longer with us. And what Keith said, he could put on some music to demonstrate the sound of the desk. And what he put on was a couple of tracks by a folky sort of boy-girl duo called Buckingham Nicks that he'd been looking after and producing. And they were in the studio themselves at the time, coincidentally, in another room. He puts on this song, Mick starts sort of, the words were grooving along. That's what they say. He started grooving along. Every time Mick Fleetwood tells his story, though, it just becomes more sort of romantic and wonderful. Glimpses of beautiful Stevie Nicks through the glass, and he hears this amazing guitarist who reminds me of Peter Green. Anyway, long story short, he goes away. Bob Welch phones him up and says, I'm leaving the band. So he's like, oh, Christ, we're back to that again. It's just him and the McVees. And then he's like, aha, but I saw this amazing duo. Well, he wanted Lindsey Buckingham, the guitarist. And of course, the story is that they had to come as a pair. But he took them out. They all went out for lunch together or dinner together in a Mexican restaurant. And, you know, a few margaritas later, they all get on great. And it's like, hey, you know, well, you can join the band as well with Stevie Nicks. So he takes the pair of them on, which, of course, is the best thing that could have possibly happened.
Yeah, that's an unbelievable story. And to have two women in the band at the same time was quite something in the 70s, I would think.
Yes, it was. I mean, and they were treated as second-class citizens. There's famous story about them being on stage during sound check and like a production manager from the theatre coming in. Get those broads off the stage. Get those broads off the stage. They thought they were someone's girlfriend.
Oh, my goodness.
That was it. But this is why, Christine, if you ever interviewed Christine McVie several times, she's the toughest cookie imaginable, and so is Stevie Nicks in different ways, because they had to deal with this sort of bullshit over a decade at least.
Right. Tell us about Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham at that point in their careers. Where were they from? How did they meet?
Yeah, well, they were at the same high school, and they met for about 10 minutes in a sort of after school music club. I think the story was that Lindsey Buckingham was playing that Mamas and Papas song, California
Dreamin'.
And Stevie Nicks came over and sort of threw in a few harmonies. And then Lindsey Buckingham was playing in a sort of college band. And then a few months later, they got Stevie Nicks in as the singer. But they weren't together as a romantic couple. They were involved with other people. But the general feeling was that, you know, for her, she said that as soon as she joined that band, she saw herself as a pop star. And so she was on a mission to go somewhere else. And they got a little record deal. They made an album that didn't sell at all, wasn't promoted. And they were living, you know, she was waitressing. She was waiting tables. He was like, I'm an artiste. I have to stay at home, right?
Yeah, but she was even cleaning houses.
She's waiting tables. And she worked in a burger chain. And he would stay at home just kind of playing guitar, having smoke, being creative, writing his songs. I don't know why she didn't just tell him to get out there and get a job. But stuck by him, and, you know, that's what, and the rest is history.
Tell us, what are their respective personalities like, the two of them, do you think?
They're very funny in different ways. I mean, Lindsey Buckingham takes things very, very seriously, took the music very, very seriously. I've noticed over the last few years, the last time I interviewed him, which would have been 2021, I think, he'd lightened up a little bit more, but he was quite intense. But that intensity is what they needed. He was absolutely focused on, I want the band to sound this way, producing the set records, helping other people's material. She, of course, was not a traditional musician. She couldn't play the instruments that he could, but she had this way of singing, way with melodies. And a lot of what she did was kind of counterintuitive. If you're a songwriter, it used to drive Lindsey Buckingham mad. Like, you can't rhyme. You've got too many words in here. That doesn't make sense. But it made sense. You listen to a song like Dreams.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, you can't do that. Well, I'm doing it. So between the two of them, it's this weird sort of dynamic.
Yeah. She's almost like a poet, and he's kind of the craftsman of the music.
Absolutely. So he's constantly trying to sort of mold it into a more conventional shape, I guess. And she's like, no, I'm doing it my way.
The band, Mark, comes out with an album in 75 called Fleetwood Mac, simply called Fleetwood Mac. And the added dimension of Stevie and Lindsey certainly starts to pay some dividends. Vocal harmonies, hits like Rhiannon. Landslide.
I took my love, took it down.
Over My Head.
And then again, you can be cold as ice. I'm over my head. Oh, but it sure feels nice.
Say You Love Me.
There's not another living soul around. You woo me until the sun comes up and you say that you love me.
What's interesting is there's a triad of writers in the band now.
That's right, yeah, because Christy McVie's got her confidence as a writer, and she said that having those two in the band encouraged her, made her up her game, but they also contributed, particularly Lindsey Buckingham, ideas to her songs. And like you say, they hadn't had a hit for years before that album.
Right. Then comes time to follow up that successful album. Could they follow up the hits on that with their next studio effort? I mean, they've set the bar high for themselves. Tell us about the absolutely what I'll call insane conditions surrounding the band as it goes into the studio in Sausalito, California, north of San Francisco, across the Golden Gate Bridge. Tell us a little bit about the atmosphere surrounding that album.
Well, you've got two couples, two romantically involved couples in the band who basically split up. I mean, the McVies have been splitting up and getting back together for a couple of years before that. Stevie Nicks said that she and Lindsey Buckingham were splitting up almost before they joined the band anyway. So it's kind of everyone sticking together. I mean, I remember interviewing Christy McVie and she said, well, you know, we weren't going to let the band fall apart for something as trivial as a divorce, which is what she said at the time. So the band came first over everything. So, but of course, you've got this unavoidable tension in the studio. So, you know, I remember Ken Kalat, the co-producer of Rumours, saying to me, you know, he'd just be sitting at the mixing desk. Suddenly he'd hear a commotion and Christy McVie throwing a glass of champagne in John McVie's face for something he'd said. Or then, you know, Lindsey and Buckingham and Stevie Nicks would be singing these beautiful harmonies together at the microphone. And the minute the button went off, that's a take, the button went off, they just start screaming at each other. Wow. And as soon as the button's back on, singing in harmony. That wasn't like that every day, all day, but you're producing a record with four people who've probably been happier not seeing each other.
And Mark, you have a third couple breaking up in Mick Fleetwood breaking up from his wife, Jenny Boyd. So that's three couples breaking up as the album is being recorded. It's unbelievable.
You know, there's no escape. The relationships had ended, but they weren't able to get away from it.
And there's an added element. Does Mick start seeing Stevie around that time?
I think that's a little bit later. It doesn't help that she then, in between, she starts a relationship with Don Henley from the Eagles. So that's like the Eagles are the biggest band. Eagles are Fleetwood Mac, aren't they? Like the two biggest bands in America.
Right.
And, you know, Don Henley's afro is as big as Lindsey Buckingham. So you got two intense guys with big hair and beard writing these songs, and he's gone off with the other one's missus. So of course you've got the added thing that not only she split up with him, she's going out with the rival band.
Right.
You know, so, but then, yes, but a bit later she takes up with Mick Fleetwood.
And the drugs starts to take a toll. I mean,
well, I think there was a lot of recreational cocaine use, but when you speak to the band members, some, it's like any band, four or five people, some have their nose in the trough more than others. Not everybody was. Lindsey Buckingham swears blind he never did as much as the others. Mick Fleetwood was the animal for it.
So with so much psychological overhead, I'll call it, it's a wonder that they even completed the album. The main songwriters, Christine McVie, Stevie Nicks, and Lindsey Buckingham all brought their baggage into their notebooks, penning songs that told stories about the circumstances. In fact, John McVie suggested calling the album Rumours because each of them was writing about each other in those journals.
Yes.
Let's go one by one through these songs rapid fire. And Mark, you tell us, you interpret the songs for the listeners, because I'm sure a lot of people have heard these songs and don't know the real story behind them. So what is Dreams about?
Dreams is Stevie Nicks saying to Lindsey Buckingham, hey, calm down, get on with your life now that I've got rid of you, now that we've split up, calm down and get on with your life.
Okay. What is Go Your Own Way about?
That's Lindsey Buckingham being very cross about breaking up with Stevie Nicks and telling her to go her own way.
Yeah, right.
There's a line in it, shacking up is all you want to do, which is obviously a very barbed comment at her. And even up until a few years ago, you could still see her cringing on stage when he sang that line.
Shacking up with, I guess, presumably what he means with other fellows, etc.
Other fellows, Don, maybe.
Yeah. All right. We move to the next song that Mark Blake, our esteemed guest, is going to interpret for us, like the tarot cards. What about You Make Loving Fun?
Make Loving Fun. Yeah, that's Christy McVie's song, supposedly for her new boyfriend, who was Fleetwood Mac's lighting engineer. So that's, she not only leaves the husband, a new guy, he's the guy that's working the light.
Oh my goodness. This is like the plot of a soap opera, like this recording of this album. Every week there's a divorce, a breakup, or somebody seeing somebody else. The next song, what about Gold Dust Woman?
Well, do you know what? That supposedly a song about drugs, but Stevie Nicks has said it's about drugs, and then other times she said it's not. It's a very spooky sounding song. I mean, I think that's a song that captures the darkness in the studio.
Back on, Gold Dust Woman. Take your silver spoon. Dig your grave.
And perhaps the last one we'll do here is The Chain. Could that be about something?
That's about all of them, isn't it? You can hit the line, you can never break the chain. That's about the five of them. Look, we're in a terrible mess, but you can't break the band. And that's why it's credited to all five of them. It's one of the few Fleetwood Mac songs where it's credited to everyone.
And that song went on to become quite famous in the F1 circuit, was it not?
Yeah. When I first heard it as a kid, it was on TV or motor racing shows.
Yeah.
Then I heard rumors and went, oh, that's the song off the
F1. Right.
I'd grown up with it, for a couple of years before I heard it.
Yeah, great tune. The resulting album from all that turmoil that Mark's just described so well, the 1977 Rumors, produced 4 top US 10 singles and remained at number 1 on the Billboard 200 for 31 weeks. It's the 8th best-selling album of all time. By 1980, Stevie, who's now about 32 years old, is getting a bit frustrated by the fact that she has difficulty getting all her songs onto Fleetwood Mac records, and it's understandable. You've got Christine McVie prolifically writing, Lindsey Buckingham as well. They're incredible songwriters in their own right. In those days, for those that don't remember albums, there was probably about 10 slots on every album. So you've got 3 writers vying for those positions. What does this lead to, which in its own way threatens the integrity of the band?
Well, you've got Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham both got solo record deals. And Lindsey Buckingham makes a solo album that isn't very successful. And Stevie Nicks makes one, which is huge. I think he goes to number 1. And of course, there's naturally feeling fear within the band that she's going to leave. Although she's adamant that she won't. But then having made that album, she then goes and makes another one that's very successful as well. So the 80s is a very strange, it's a sensitive period
The early 80s are here. The impact of their relentless touring lifestyle, a few things happen to individuals in the band. Do you want to just comment on that?
Everybody goes off and does solo things. And Mick Fleetwood goes bankrupt, so he gets them back together. Well, but either way, he's like, I've got to get Fleetwood Mac back together now.
Yeah.
What persuades Lindsey Buckingham back? But at that time, Stevie Nicks had gone into the Betty Ford Clinic, you know, which was a very famous rehab center at that time. And she goes in there to get off cocaine. So she does join the sessions for the album that became Tango in the Night, but she's kind of underrepresented on the album. Lindsey Buckingham has talked about, you know, she was there for just a few days and he had to work very, very hard to get her voice and her song on that album, which I think you can hear when you listen to it. Lots of it feels like a Lindsey Buckingham solo record or Christine McVie record.
Yeah, so that's Tango in the Night in 87.
Tango in the Night, yeah, 19.
And it's got Sweet Little Lies. Written by Christine, but I guess it would not be Fleetwood Mac without another incident that sparks someone leaving the band. This is like an episode of the reality show Cops. What happens next? They have a meeting at Christine McVie's house, presumably to talk about maybe the upcoming tour.
Tour booked. That's why I had tour booked. And Lindsey Buckingham turned up and said, look, I'm not going to do the tour. And the reason he gave for that is he just couldn't stand, his version is that he couldn't stand the amount of drug use that it was in band, and he just couldn't face going on the road again, at which point him and Stevie Nicks get into a massive fight. She's accused him of some things, he's denied them. We don't know. John McVie gets in the middle of it.
It becomes physical is what you're
going to say. It supposedly becomes physical, and it happens outside on the cars outside Christine McVie's sort of mansion. So probably, you know, someone sort of over the bonnet of a Rolls Royce. Anyway, Lindsey Buckingham leaves and Fleetwood Mac do the tour with two other guitarists to replace him.
Yeah, Billy Burnett and Rick Vito.
That's right, yeah.
The unknown guitar players of Fleetwood Mac. So the band then goes on without Buckingham, as you said, but essentially it takes a hiatus for a few years until one of their songs makes a comeback. And maybe talk a little bit about who brought that song back.
That's right. I mean, they did make a couple of albums, I should say, in the 80s that nobody remembers. And they weren't very good. And they did tour, and they did, you know, but it's diminishing returns. Then Bill Clinton has Don't Stop as his kind of campaign song.
Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, yeah.
About Tomorrow, that's right, which he loved from Rumours. I think he was a governor of Arkansas or something when that album came out. He loved that song. Apparently, his campaign people said, look, it's the 90s. Why have you got a Fleetwood Mac song? You know, they're not cool, but he insists on it. And they, various sleight of hand and conversations, the five of them, the classic lineup, get back together to play his inauguration ball in Maryland in 92. They get up on stage. There's some fabulous footage online of the Clintons joining them on stage. Bill has a tambourine, which he tries to play, but they gaffer tape the bells on it so it doesn't make a noise. He doesn't Yeah, they gaffer tape that, and then he quickly gives it to an aide. But yeah, that song had a second wind because it was his campaign song, and I think he carried on using it after that.
And so then we fast forward, I guess we go into the 2009-10s. McVie, yeah. I guess, doesn't like flying. Is that sort of the reason that she's not touring? Or she
didn't want to tour. Yeah, she just left and she wanted to go back to England, live in England. I think her father was very ill at the time. I remember interviewing her about this and she just said, I've had enough. Just want to go home. Yeah. She said, she wanted to open a restaurant, which she never did. But she went and lived in a big house in the country and she became a little bit agoraphobic. And then a few years later, she came back to the band. She decided she wanted to do it again, I think, before it was too late. But yes.
It's basically the touring classic hits tours.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I guess for a couple of years, they're all together, the Fab Five, we'll call them, 2016 to 2018. But then more drama. Lindsay quits. Now, why does he quit? What's the circumstances there? I mean, he seems like a mercurial fellow at the best of times, but what's...
Well, he had to quit because it was either him or Stevie Nicks. And so they chose Stevie Nicks. He'd upset her in some way. There's various stories about this. He supposedly smirked behind her while she was on stage giving a speech at a charity event, which you can look at it online. I looked at it and the others are all kind of laughing because she chats quite a long time.
Right.
But I interviewed Lindsay Buckingham. He said he was doing some solo touring and he wanted them to delay their tour to accommodate him. But at the end of the day, if you had to choose, they can't go on the road without Stevie Nicks.
Yeah. Who's the biggest star, right?
Stevie Nicks. They have to, as long as, and I remember talking to Lindsay Buckingham about this and he said, look, I understand how it works because he said, half the people in a football stadium watching Fleetwood Mac don't even know I'm not there. He said, as long as they see Stevie Nicks, they don't care.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe Mick Fleetwood. They don't care.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And so they went out on the road without it.
Yeah. And they picked up Mike Campbell of the Tom Petty Band as a guitarist and Neil Finn of the 80s bands Split Enz and Crowded House.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
What is their legacy? Let's get to the sort of, where does Fleetwood Mac stand in music history? What made them unique?
I think what made them unique at the time is having, like you say, three strong songwriters who all wrote hits, having two women in the band that wrote and sang and performed. They weren't secondary, they weren't backing singers. They were performers. Christine McVie was a great piano player. You know, Stevie, they both wrote songs, but also it's that kind of, it's the transition of the music. It's what they started at and what they became. Completely different, but there's this sort of weird thread that runs through it. And, you know, whether that's down to the rhythm section, I can't quite put my finger on what it is. Well, I've tried in this book, but I think there's a unity to everything they did somehow. But I think it crosses boundaries and genres, and a lot of people listening, a lot of musicians now grew up listening to that music, and you can hear it. You can hear it in country music. You can hear it in a lot of folk rock, a lot of pop music. It's there. You can hear Rumours in so much stuff now. It's never really gone out of date. It has, Rumours hasn't dated. You know, a lot of that, like you say, the Fab Five stuff, it's timeless.
Give me one or two words to describe each member of that Classic Five lineup. I'll give you the name. You give me the couple words.
Okay.
Mick Fleetwood.
Aristocratic.
Very good. How about we go to John McVie? We haven't talked about him much.
Down to earth.
Christine McVie.
Even more down to earth.
Lindsay Buckingham.
Tortured genius.
That's brilliant. Stevie Nicks.
Fairy queen.
She has got her own contingent of fans that are incredible.
It's extraordinary to see. Yes.
All right, Mark, we're now at that point where we've got to choose, our guests choose three lesser known cuts. Everyone knows the hits, but what should we listen to on sort of the backsides or early albums? What are some lesser known cuts?
You mentioned the Future Gains album, the title track of that, which is a Bob Welch song. I heard it again because it was in the Cameron Crowe movie, Almost Famous. So I would choose Future Games because that's one of these sort of unusual songs that's in the middle between Peter Green era and the Fab Five era. I'll choose a couple of others, though, from the Nicks Buckingham era. Things like, I think, Silver Springs, which is a Stevie Nicks song that was left off Rumours. She desperately wanted it on Rumours.
She was not happy about that.
No, she went mad because they took it off and didn't tell her. And she got it put back on the later reissues when they do these box sets. But it's a great song.
That's a brilliant song.
It's a brilliant song. There's also another Stevie Nicks song called Beautiful Child, which is on Tusk. And her songs on the album are really sad. And this is about her having an affair with the Beatles' old publicist, Derek Taylor, who was about 15 years older than her and married. And she had a fling with him and wrote a song about it. But she didn't tell anyone it was about him until after he died.
Oh.
But it's a great song.
I'm old enough to love you from afar. To trust in yes, but then women usually are.
Stevie certainly has, the praise of the younger generation, the Taylor Swifts and all these young performers absolutely love her.
Yeah, she did a track with Lana Del Rey, which is a really good song. She's got that. She translates to other generations. She's big fans with Harry Styles. You know, he worships her.
Right. Yeah.
Again, it's that timelessness because she's kind of like she was in the 70s. She's just an older woman now. She never changed.
Yeah.
She never changed. She just grew old and carried on wearing what she was wearing before.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Mark, this has been a real pleasure to have you on the show, and we appreciate it.
Thanks. Hope it's all good.
Some closing notes on Fleetwood Mac. We talked about the Stevie Nicks, Lindsey Buckingham romantic relationship and virtual rivalry to this day to outdo each other. While if you use industry accolades as the measure of success, Stevie Nicks stands alone as one of the few performers nominated to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, both as an individual artist and as a member of a band, Fleetwood Mac. Today's guest, Mark Blake, talked about the enduring legacy of their pinnacle album, 1977, entitled Rumors. In May of 2011, an episode of the TV show Glee, entitled Rumors, featured six songs from that album. The show sparked renewed interest in the band and its most commercially successful album. And incredibly, the 35-year-old album, Rumors, re-entered the Billboard 200 chart at number 11 in the same week of the Glee episode. We mentioned that one band member left to join a cult. During a US tour in 1971, the group suffered a loss when founding member Jeremy Spencer went out to buy a magazine, quote unquote, and instead joined a religious cult called the Children of God. Musicians often work other jobs before their big break, and the Fleetwood Mac members were no exception. We discussed how Stevie Nicks cleaned houses, while Mick Fleetwood was supposed to be a window cleaner before helping found the band. And John McVie, the bassist, was already training to be a tax inspector when his opportunity came. Hard to imagine a drugged out John McVie coming around to collect your retail sales tax. In April 2018, the Stevie Nicks penned song Dreams re-entered the Hot Rock Songs chart at number 16 after a viral meme featuring someone filming themselves skateboarding while drinking cranberry juice to the tune. Dreams almost immediately spiked on streaming platforms with 8.5 million streams in a matter of days. This chart re-entry came 40 years after the song had topped the Hot 100. You can visit our website, garagetostadiums.com, and see the show notes for this episode to find the official Garage to Stadiums Fleetwood Mac playlist, including guest Mark Blake's three lesser-known picks and the transcripts for the episode. While there, we've also included videos of the different iterations of Fleetwood Mac throughout the decades, including the initial blues era fronted by Peter Green in a clip from 1969 from the BBC show Monster Mash. Also, we have an amazing performance from 1976 of their hit Rihanna on the NBC show Midnight Special, which ran for several years in the US and featured popular rock bands of the day performing their hits. We've also included clips of the reuniting of the band in 1992, 10 years after they last toured. They are actually performing the Bill Clinton campaign song Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow with Bill and, oddly, Michael Jackson. We hope you enjoyed our show today. Special thanks to our guest, Mark Blake, author of Dreams, the A to Z of Fleetwood Mac, and our producer, Reese Waters. You've been listening to Garage to Stadiums, another Blast Furnace Labs production. I'm Dave Anthony. See you next time for another Garage to Stadiums story.
This has been a Podstarter production.